Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Hi, welcome to the show. We're going to get started here in just a second. But first, if you're only listening to the free portion of the Bob Seska Show on Apple Podcasts.
Hey folks, Alex Jones here. I've hacked into this podcast to warn you all not to subscribe to Bob Seska's Patreon page. If you sign up at BobSeskaShow.com, you're going to be supporting the globalists with their chemtrails and weather weapons, tiny airplanes and helicopters moving the tornadoes all around. And we all know Bob is conspiring with Raytheon, Bechtel, IBM, the Bilderbergs, Agenda 21, Big Tech, Big Pharma, the Trilateral Commission. I got the documents right here. Here are the documents. I've got proof that Bob's Patreon is turning the friggin' frogs gay. So do not sign up for his Patreon page because I said so.
BobSeskaShow.com or Patreon.com/BobSeskaShow. And now let the cartoons begin.
The Bob Seska Show.
Bob Seska.
Nerd!
The Bob Seska Show.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, August 11, 2021, and this is the interview edition of the Bob Seska Show on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. Hi, my name is Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hello, day 204 of the Biden-Harris administration, 454 days until the 22 midterms. Find me on Instagram at TheBobSeska and on Twitter at BobSeska_go. I can't believe it's taken us so long to get here, but the amazing Travis Bone joins me on today's show. Travis, of course, is the executive producer of The Stephanie Miller Show, the greatest political radio show of all time, the gold standard for how liberal talk radio is supposed to work. But today, I should warn you, we spend a ton of time talking about nerd things, comic book movies and TV series and so on. But we also get into Travis's role on The Stephanie Miller Show, as well as how he landed in broadcast radio in the first place. So grab a snack and get ready for two tall guys totally nerding out today. Meantime, don't forget to support this podcast at patreon.com/BobSeskaShow. Okay, here comes real-life superhero, Travis Bone.
The only toys I buy are Transformers.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
That's the only, that was like my thing as a kid.
Yeah.
And if you want to get into toxic fandom, that is the most toxic fandom you'll ever see, and it's their fucking robots.
Transformers came sort of a little bit after I started to get into like high school things like heavy metal and girls.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so I missed out on Transformers, but my brothers all had Transformers. So I was aware enough, especially of the early toys and, of course, the cartoon series. Just through them. And that was my experience with Transformers. It was more by proxy than anything else.
I was 10 years old when they came out. And it's kind of fun. That was actually my gateway into comic books because Marvel made the Transformers comic book.
Yeah.
And then from there, I did G.I. Joe. And then I started collecting the New Mutants because they were like the young X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
And like I felt more like something with that. And that branched me into X-Factor back when it was the original X-Men. Were X-Factor.
Yeah.
And then it just kind of like, then crossovers happen and it's like, well, you got to read this book if you read that book. And then.
Are Transformers, are those sort of your centerpiece interest when it comes to this stuff? It's sort of like, for me, it's Star Wars. The superhero stuff I've always loved, but Star Wars is the thing that I always come back to.
It's the thing that I collect.
Yeah.
And I fully recognize the fact that the movies are shit. And, you know, I go back to, and it's funny, I think this Friday they're doing a big thing because it's the 35th anniversary of the Transformers animated movie. That was like, the voice cast for that movie was Judd Nelson, Robert Stack, Leonard Nimoy.
Oh my God.
Orson Welles. I mean, it was like the voice casting was just insane.
Yeah.
Eric Idle.
Uh-huh. Right.
Was one of the voices in it.
And it also had the song that they reused on Boogie Nights. There's yes. a song that Dirk Diggler makes.
No, You've Got the Touch.
You've Got the Touch. That's from the Transformers movie, right?
Yes. And, so I'd never seen Boogie Nights.
Yeah.
And Dylan and I started dating. He's like, how have you not seen Boogie Nights? How have you not seen Boogie Nights? And about a half hour into the movie, Dylan has this moment where he's like, oh my God, you're about to lose your mind. Because he realizes that song is coming up.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, what? Well, I don't know what you're talking about. And then all of a sudden, like, it cuts to Donnie Wahlberg singing that song. And I'm just like, oh my God.
Yeah, it's incredible. It blew my mind when I found out that the song, because I had seen it first in Boogie Nights. I didn't realize that it was in the Transformers movie, too. And I said, oh, holy shit. They just went to the Transformers movie? That's insane that they've used that song of all songs.
And technically, that's somebody point out to me that that song came out after Boogie Nights was set. So it is. And like chronologically, it could not have happened.
Okay. So, right. So the scene in Boogie Nights is
set in the 70s, I think.
Yeah. I think it's like 1981 or two or something like that. It's definitely before the Transformers movie comes out.
And that movie came out in 86.
Right. And then Boogie Nights came out in 97.
Right.
So yes, we're completely confusing everybody listening in. And that's the next question I was going to ask you about, because we just had the Suicide Squad come out this past weekend.
Yeah.
Marvel, meanwhile, is going into this whole multiverse territory, which DC is also going into, too. It's like they're back in the like the golden age of the comic books. There were all these parallels happening because the same people who are working on DC were also working on Marvel and vice versa. Crossing over. Jack Kirby in particular would cross over between the two companies.
The perfect example of that is Darkseid. And the New Gods and the Apocalypse and all that stuff, which I know you're super familiar with. The Eternals that are coming out.
Yeah.
The Marvel movie comes out this November. I believe Jack Kirby went over to Marvel and created them to be their response to Apocalypse and the New Gods and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
So it's like you said, it kind of goes back and forth. And then, like you said, with Suicide Squad, you can see James Gunn's hands all over that and the Guardians of the Galaxy. I see a similarity between Suicide Squad and Guardians of the Galaxy, like prison breaks and stuff like that. And the use of music and things like that, which I loved.
And there's something that James Gunn does. I want to get back to the multiverse here in a second, but there's something that James Gunn does that's sort of his comedy signature, which is almost this vibe that you get from some of the characters, not all the characters. But some of the side characters, like certainly Drax in Guardians of the Galaxy,
but
to a certain extent, Quill, where Quill is very similar to Peacemaker insofar as they're both like 12-year-olds in adult bodies. They act like they're much younger than they actually are. Yeah, exactly right. And of course, Drax is like King Shark, and they're kind of just doofuses. And that's
and then
sort
Groot
of
and Raccoon too. And Groot and Rock. Well, I would compare Rocket to Ratcatcher's. What was his name? The little rat.
The rat was not Milton, but it was something else. Milton was the guy. The office.
Milton
worker.
Was the guy who died.
Yeah, he was the bus driver. I forget the name of the rat.
He was like.
I know what you're talking about.
He reminded me of like a Rocket or a Groot, where it's like they're not saying anything. But and I didn't realize this. Did you catch who the voice was for King Shark?
Sylvester Stallone. Yeah.
I had no idea. Dylan's the one who told me that. I was like, what? I go to IMDb a lot. And during the movie, I was going to IMDb, but I didn't look to see who the voice of King Shark was, which is dummy on my part.
See, I spoil all this stuff for me. See, because I'm on, you know, Slash Film and comicbook.com and all these websites.
Oh, I am too.
Months and months, if not years, before these movies come out. So I'm familiar with the production and sort of the rumor mill that goes on around all that crap. It started way back before the prequels came out, the Star Wars prequels with theforce.net and some of those sites. That became the gateway to following all of the antics that happened behind the scenes during the production of these movies. But I wanted to ask you about the multiverse that both of these universes of films are going toward. and whether or not general audiences are going to be able to track with it, because some of the plot details and the world building is happening on like Disney Plus, or in the case of maybe HBO Max for the DC universe. Is that going to be something that's going to lose general audiences for some of these films? Are some people going to go, yeah, you know what? This is too confusing. I can't keep up with the TV shows. I don't know. What timeline are we on? Why are all these people all mixed up in the same universe together? And because time travel is inherently confusing.
Problematic in general.
Yeah, exactly. Unless you're really totally wired into it. So is that going to be a problem for these movies moving forward?
I'm curious. Well, so as far as like dealing with multiverse type stuff, DC on their TV side on the CW last year did Crisis on Infinite Earths. Mm-hmm. They did that using the TV series where they used the Flash and Green Arrow, Black Lightning, Supergirl, and Batwoman. Mm-hmm. I think were the shows they mixed in with that. But then they went and they dug deep into the well, because on the woman who plays Alice on Batgirl, mm-hmm. or Batwoman.
Yeah.
I don't think you watched the show, but the woman who plays Alice on Batwoman, who's the villain, mm-hmm. she was in the Birds of Prey series that was on the WB network that lasted for one season.
Wow.
So when they did their whole Infinite Crisis thing, they actually had her go back and play her original character in a different universe. Right. And then you also had, oh my God, why am I blanking on his name right now? Original Dick Grayson.
Yeah.
Burt Ward.
Oh, right, yeah.
Burt Ward had a cameo. Brandon Routh, who was on the DC show Legends of Tomorrow, played Superman in an alternate universe because he was Superman in the movie. Right. So they did a lot of crazy stuff like that as far as mixing it around. So DC did that, and they had built out the idea of a multiverse through the Flash, because he mm-hmm. can cross universes and stuff like that on their shows. But I think what Marvel's doing right now is really, really smart, because if you think about it, they've like tiptoed into this since Avengers Endgame, because the Ancient One said, if you take these time stones, you cause, and that you saw the little timelines.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Which was just represented again in the Loki series. They represented it the same way. Yeah.
Right. So they've kind of like given you this foundation, and Loki, they did a good job of really explaining, like, here's why there's the one sacred timeline and there was a universal war. Mm. And they kind of explained how it all came to, like, how it all fits together. And Loki broke the timeline.
Yeah. Right.
So I feel like they've done a good job with establishing that idea of a multiverse mm-hmm. in Marvel. And then, you know, we've got Spider-Man No Way Home, I believe, is the next one that's coming out.
Yeah.
And that's, I know it's hard to keep track of everything. So they're saying that one's going to be dealing with the multiverse.
Right.
Doctor Strange is the Multiverse of Madness, mm-hmm. which is coming out. And that's, so, I mean, obviously they're just like directly leaning into it. And then What If starts today on Disney Plus.
Right.
And they're using, are you familiar with What If?
Yes. It's oh no, not the comic book. I didn't even know there was a comic book that went along with this.
Back when I got into comic books, and it wasn't something I read on a regular basis, but What If was this character, the Watcher, Uatu, who is, he showed up in, I think it was one of the Easter eggs at the end of Guardians.
Okay.
And it was weird because it was Stan Lee was explaining something to a bunch of Watchers looking down at him.
That's right.
I think it was Guardians of the Galaxy 2 where they did that.
Yeah.
And, but anyway, so they've, anyways, in the comic book, What If, the Watcher basically was saying, here's what if such and such happened. Mm-hmm. And it was like stories from the multiverse.
Yeah.
And so what they're doing now, and I think this is kind of, again, smart on Marvel's part, is I think the cartoon is going to be a primer for multiverses.
Interesting.
Because we just broke the timeline in Loki, and the next series is going to be a guy saying, well, what if in this universe this happened? And the first episode drops today, and it's Captain Carter. And it's what if Agent Carter, Peggy Carter from the Captain America movies, took the serum instead of Steve Rogers.
And I'm imagining everyone listening to this going, you guys have completely lost me. And that's my genuine concern, because, you know, ultimately it affects us nerds, because if general audiences start to pull away from these movies, then the budgets start to go down and there are fewer of them. And that negatively affects us because we love these things and we're following these stories up close, no matter where they're happening. Although I have to say, you're much more deeply ensconced in like the CW series and all of the TV versions of the DC universe. For some reason, I started watching The Flash in season one. And I lost track of it. And then suddenly, and I didn't even start with Arrow, which came before it. But then there was The Flash. And now there are all these shows. And it's almost too intimidating to go back and start to catch up with everything, given the other new content that's also out there to watch. So there's just this immense wealth of content. And so it's hard for me to keep up with that. But what is it about the TV shows, specifically the DC shows, like on the CW and so on? Mm-hmm. What is it about those? I mean, what am I missing? What's like the selling point? If you had to convince me to watch those shows starting now, what would be your pitch?
Oh, that's okay. First of all, it's really hard. It's funny. I had a conversation with a buddy of mine, which, by the way, if I can make a podcast recommendation for you. A friend of mine hosts a podcast called The Geek Buddies.
Okay.
And they'll do synopsises and breakdowns of like WandaVision, Falcon Winter Soldier, Loki they did. But then they also do like a weekly show where it's just, they talk about here's what's going on in geek news and stuff like that. And anyways, one of my buddies is a host of that. He also was the lead writer and showrunner for My Little Pony.
Wow. Cool. So he's in the world already.
Yeah. So he's in the world already. And he was like head of animation over at Sony at one point. Mm-hmm. And so he was there when they were doing all the Spider-Man reboots for animation and the Spider-Man cartoon. So he's legit. He's got cred. And the way we had this conversation, not maybe a month ago. And he said, it's so hard to look at the CW shows and watch them now.
Hmm.
Because when they came out, it was like, oh, this is great. This is cool. It's TV special effects and TV budgets.
Yeah.
But now that you've had like WandaVision, Falcon and Winter Soldier, it's like watching the CW shows, it's like some of them are kind of painful to watch right now. Like
that's the special effects. Yeah.
I will say that, and I think there's a budget issue on or a budgetary reason for this. I mentioned to you Titans.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The first two seasons were done on the DC Universe, which was like their streaming platform that kind of fell apart and it's kind of been absorbed into the HBO Max.
Right.
The first two seasons of Titans, you could tell there was a different budget for those shows compared to what was on the CW. And now the Superman and Lois show that's airing on CW was actually originally for HBO Max.
Okay. Yeah.
So there is a definite difference in production values for that show and just visually what it is, the way the show looks and feels compared to the other CW shows. The other CW shows look really cheesy right now, especially Supergirl this season. I love it. I have friends that work on that show. It's painful. And I'm watching it still just because they're doing the last season. They're wrapping it up.
Mm-hmm.
But it's pretty rough right now on some of the CW shows. I'll admit that.
Kevin Smith did a whole bit in his stand-up about The Flash and how great The Flash is, how he and Jason Mewes are just wrapped into The Flash as if it's like, you know, this adult soap opera that they're so wired into. They love it so much. And he does this whole pitch for especially watching season one of The Flash that really makes me want to jump into it. I mean, is it as good as what people are saying?
Of the CW shows, I would say The Flash is the best. Mm-hmm. It had all the heart of The Flash. And I mean, if you think about it, comic books are soap operas for boys.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want a gender type, but like traditionally, more guys read comic books than girls. They're soap operas.
Mm-hmm.
And just like a soap opera, they reset every once in a while. They have their you know, the big shocking cliffhanger moments and, oh my gosh, I have to tune in next week to see what's happening. It's like, it's like Dallas or Dynasty or Melrose Place.
right.
But for guys or nerds, I guess I should say nerds now because that's what it is. And I think that's part of the reason that kind of Dylan asked me this. I'm sure you get questions from Kimberly all the time about stuff like this.
Yes. When she gives a shit. Yes. She asks, she asks me questions when she gives a shit. Yeah.
Same here. Because Dylan will sit down, like he sat down and watched Suicide Squad with me. And he's like, look, I get it. It was well made.
Mm-hmm.
it's for 16-year-olds and it's not for me, but I appreciate that it was a good movie, that it was well done, and I could actually watch it and be entertained by it. You know, the first Suicide Squad movie, he did not feel that way about.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing that you got him to watch it. In fact, I was watching the Suicide Squad Saturday afternoon and Kimberly came through the room and she was like, oh, is that the Suicide Squad? I was like, how the hell did you know what that even was? Because she's not even wired into it. Yeah. So between King Shark and the Suicide Squad and King Shark in season one of The Flash, the TV series, which is the better King Shark of the two?
Oh, Suicide Squad.
Yeah.
On The Flash, in Suicide Squad 2, he was. He's kind of like the butt of a joke in The Flash. Like, he just kind of like is one of those characters who shows up and doesn't really do a whole... It's like he just shows up, eats someone, and disappears. Like, they've never... I don't think he's been, like, the main villain for an entire episode.
Yeah.
It's just kind of like, oh, no, it's King Shark. And then... because they don't have the special effects budget to do a whole lot with them.
Right.
I mean, they did... on The Flash, they did Gorilla Grodd.
Oh, yeah.
That was really interesting to see them do that. And that was early on in The Flash where they did Gorilla Grodd. Mm-hmm. And they've brought him back a few times. But again, it's like they don't have the budget to CG a gorilla.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, doing a whole lot. So most of what it is it's because he has telepathic powers. And so it's just this gorilla sitting there while other people are talking for him. Like, the gorilla never speaks.
I see. Hey, you know what? That's pretty clever. That's a good way to circumvent the budget problem. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I know. I totally understand why they did it that way. And it's like one of those things. And that's, you probably get this too, like watching movies and stuff like this, is what works in a comic book doesn't work in a movie necessarily. Right. And so it's finding a way to make things work in a real world. I mean, I'm hesitant to use that word when we're talking about comics, but like Suicide Squad, Starro.
Yeah.
As the bad guy. To me, in the comic books or in the cartoons, whenever Starro shows up, it's always a psychological story because those things attach to their faces and they're stuck in this fantasy world where it's like, why would I want to get out of this? This is perfect. Meanwhile, Starro's feeding off of all of their serotonin or whatever is being released. Mm-hmm. And so they never did a fantasy sequence like that in the Suicide Squad. It was just that there was this big giant starfish stomping around.
Which was fucking great. I mean, such a great move. Yeah.
It's like, how do you take a character like Starro that's like the psychological villain and make it appealing on the big screen? And they did it.
Yeah.
They totally made it work. The only other way they could have done it is if they had one of those starfishes attached to somebody's face and you got to see them having their like fantasy sequence in their head, which could have made for some interesting visuals. If they went there, but I also get why they didn't, because like that's a can of worms. Like once you open it up a little bit, then you have to go, so much further with it. So let's just have a giant starfish smashing the town. And again, you had people speaking for the starfish like they did with Gorilla Grodd.
It's got to be so amazing to sit down. You're James Gunn and you're getting ready to write the Suicide Squad. It's got to be incredible to sit down and go through all of those old characters and just like a buffet laid out in front of you of all of these, not only iconic and memorable characters, but all these weird side characters, like the detachable boy is a character that appears, I think, once in one comic. It's just a superhero whose arms are able to separate from his body and go around and do things separately. And you see the character for just 1 second. James Gunn uses this character for the first, I don't want to spoil it,
but
he uses this character in the movie. And it's not only an interesting character named TDK in the movie, but the way he applies the detachable arms in the movie is so fucking funny.
I mean, and I think that's kind of like what the Suicide Squad does the best, is they take these, especially the random villains that they can bring in. I think that's true in the comic book as well as the movies. It's like they can take these random villains that are like, oh, it's just, they were like the rogues gallery, like C-list in most cases for these people. And they bring them in and they can make them into something a little bit more interesting or make them into something fun. Because like, I mean, like, I would say that like Harley Quinn is the only like A-list villain in Suicide Squad. Even Bloodsport, he's not that big of a DC villain. Like you think of, I keep wanting to say Deadpool. It's not Deadpool. It's Deathstroke.
Yeah.
You think of Deathstroke as, as the villain.
And he was originally supposed to be the head of Team 2 in the Suicide Squad. There was, some concept art where Deathstroke is leading the second team that arrives at Corto Maltese. But they, I think they switched it to Bloodsport. Probably happened somewhere around the deal with Idris Elba and Will Smith and who was going to come in, who's going to play that lead role. And so that was one of their possibilities. But I'm glad they went with Bloodsport because by far my favorite character in that movie.
Well, and Idris Elba was so great in that. And it's kind of funny if you think, it's funny when we were watching it, Dylan looked at me because I drug him to see the original Suicide Squad because that's when I was working on Geeking Out, the TV show with Kevin Smith.
Oh, right.
And that came out when we were filming. And so it's kind of like, I have to go see this movie because I know that Kevin is going to make some sort of comment about it. I need to have at least seen this movie, even though I know this movie is going to be utter shit. Mm-hmm. And it didn't disappoint in that regard, the first one. But I remember Kevin Smith, even he was like, his reaction was, you could tell he was trying to find something to like hang his hat on about that movie. And on Geeking Out, he's like, just getting that one shot of Harley in her costume like she wore in the Batman animated series where she was first introduced when she was doing that dance with the Joker, who was dressed like he was in the animated series.
He's pulled right from I think it's Alex Ross who draws the painting. Yeah. Amazing shot.
He's like, that's all I needed from that movie. And I was happy.
Yeah.
And I totally get where he's coming from there. Yeah.
Do you think the Suicide Squad suffered from a lack of marquee characters? Is that maybe one of the reasons why its box office performance doesn't seem to match the quality of the film? Is that a possibility there?
I saw a couple of takes on that. One is there's this thing going around. I don't know if you've heard about it, but it's called Delta, and it's a virus. Mm-hmm.
And I'm a little bit familiar. Yes,
you could go to a crowded movie theater. Mm-hmm. And watch that movie, or you could watch it at home on HBO Max with your entire family for $10 a month.
Right.
So I totally get I think HBO really shot themselves in the foot this whole year not HBO, Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
Shot themselves in the foot with their movie releases by putting them on HBO Max. I think that was a ding against it because it's like, why go to a movie theater? Because I can see it for free at home. Mm-hmm. Delta variant is going around. Why do I want to go to a crowded movie theater and sit with a bunch of German infested people who are not wearing masks and unvaccinated?
Yeah.
And then also I think, there's an article I read over the weekend that talked about it suffered from, they called it the Tomb Raider syndrome.
I heard that. Explain
the first
that.
Tomb Raider movie was terrible. Mm-hmm. And the second one came out and it was the superior movie.
Yeah.
But no one saw the second one because the first one. And I know you and I have different opinions on the DC movies. I think that there have been more misses than hits.
Oh, I agree. I agree with you on that. It's just which ones are the misses. That's where we disagree, I think.
True. Yeah. But there's been more hits than misses with the DC movies. And so, it's one of those things where I'd rather hedge my bets. It's like, if I can watch this on HBO Max as opposed to going and watching it on the big screen, I'm going to go with HBO Max because they haven't. And by the way, it's one of those things, I could see this movie performing better in a second week because people were like, oh, I saw it on HBO Max. I really enjoyed it. I want to see this on. I want to see a giant fucking starfish tear apart a town.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Spoiler alert for anyone who doesn't know. But I think there's a shot of him in the trailer where the guy in the control room says, we've got to kaiju.
Yes. Oh, holy shit. Yeah. It's in fact, going back to Starro the Conqueror, it was the first issue of the Justice League comic book. I think that Starro is the villain in that. Am I getting that right?
What?
Yeah.
I don't remember who, they've rebooted the Justice League comic book so many times.
Yeah.
And it seems like every time they do a reboot of the Justice League comic book, it's because there's an alien invasion and all of the heroes have to come together to face off.
Oh, gotcha.
To face that invasion. Cause I feel like sorry fans for listening to this right now. I think when they rebooted like the New 52.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
That was, it was an apocalypse invasion, which is like the characters from the Justice League movie.
Right.
And I think in the Justice League, one of the animated movies, it was an alien invasion. It was kind of like a nondescript random, one of the animated ones that's available on HBO Max is for the record.
Oh, right.
But
right.
But it seems like Alien Invasion is when the Justice League has to get together. And by the way, the same thing with the Avengers for the first movie.
Right.
They got together because of an Alien Invasion. The third one, Alien Invasion. The second one, because they fucked shit up and they made Ultron, who wanted to take over the world.
Right. Which I thought was a great premise for that film. It just, you know, Joss Whedon kind of fumbled a little bit, but I still think it's a good movie. I still like that.
It's funny. I went back and revisited that after watching WandaVision.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, like rewatching Age of Ultron after watching WandaVision, and also Falcon and Winter Soldier is really, really interesting, because you forget that Age of Ultron came out after Captain America Winter Soldier.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like Hydra's falling apart. Age of Ultron is really a precursor for WandaVision and Falcon and Winter Soldier.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Which I feel like watching that is a good primer for those two TV series, which is, it's probably the least watched of the Marvel movies, or at least the Avengers movies.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And one of the things that I've been observing, and it's disappointing insofar as it's part of the things that I love. It's in The Mandalorian. It's in The Suicide Squad. There are so many examples of what I'm about to describe, which is there's a lot of humanizing and empathizing with the villains in these shows. Certainly The Suicide Squad. We're talking about a team of villains, super villains, metahumans who are normally in the comics evildoers, to use the George W. Bush 9/11 term. And with The Mandalorian, we see many instances of, well, let's look at this from the perspective of the Imperials. What were the Imperials thinking when the Death Star blew up? Oh, we lost all of our friends in this terrorist attack. And we're starting to see these events where it was a very clearly defined good versus evil setup. We're starting to be treated to the perspective from the bad guys in these shows and movies. And I get concerned that that is desensitizing people to the actual villainy that we're seeing in real life. And now I really hesitate not to apply art to people's opinions in real life, because then you get into weird territory. Does a Judas Priest album make a kid want to commit suicide, or whatever it was, or an Ozzy Osbourne song? That's a territory I don't normally go into, but because we're in this time period where we're facing an existential crisis, where there are millions and millions and millions of people supporting a genuine villain in someone like Donald Trump. What do you think about that? Have you noticed that, or am I overreacting?
I think one of the weird ones, I think one of the first times where we really saw people like, identify with it's a strange one. And Dylan's a better person to talk about this than I am. Where we saw that at was the Dark Knight.
Oh yeah.
And it was, you know, it was after the Dark Knight was when we had the shooting in Colorado, where the guy went to the movie theater dressed as the Joker.
All right. Yeah.
And, but so many of these people who are in these militia movements and stuff, they point to things like, Batman and the Dark Knight is like, they're kind of like their inspiration. Like they really glom onto that movie. It's not science fiction or comic book stuff, but, the militia movement, a lot of them look at Rambo, the original First Blood movie.
Yeah.
That, they look at him as like, look at him taking on the corrupt law. And he was the outcast, and they envisioned themselves, these doughboys showing up in their, you know, cosplay camo stuff at the Capitol. But they think that they see themselves like Rambo, as standing up to the law and standing for the little guy. And so, you know, I think it's been going on outside of, you know, comic book movies. It's not necessarily just the comic book movies and the sci-fi stuff that we talk about, but I get what you're saying, but I also think that there is gray area.
I'm wondering if this is not part of the palette of why we're here, or is this going to create eventual damage down the road where we're like, well, yeah, just look at it through Donald Trump's eyes. Maybe he's upset, or he's got some sort of psychological problem that's making him do all these bad things. That's what I kind of worry about.
There's no sympathizing with the devil on that. There's no sympathizing with the devil on that one for me.
Yeah.
It's funny, you know, I've mentioned this to you, and I was like debating if I was going to bring this up. I've mentioned to you that I might be working on a project of my own that's like delving into politics and pop culture and that
stuff.
Oh
yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm still in the early phases of that. So I don't want to get too deep into it, but it's a project that I'm working on. And like one of the examples that like to throw out what you're saying, you're talking about, you know, villains being humanized, but the movie Captain America Civil War, who were you rooting for in that?
It's funny. I was rooting for, strangely enough, I was rooting for the Captain America team Captain America, that side of it, not the Tony Stark side, but the Captain America side, which was more of like, you know what?
Deregulation, no oversight. Tony Stark, who was the bad guy in the movie, was actually for regulation and regulation of powers. And it's like,
yes,
he's kind of right. Cause I don't know if I necessarily want unlicensed people running around with superpowers. You know, which is like, in some ways you could say is a metaphor for guns.
Yeah. 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 You know what? Fuck it. You're right. You're totally right. But I was supporting the
DeSantis
wrong side.
DeSantis keeps talking about, we don't want government telling you need to wear masks. I mean, it
yeah.
Do you see the similarities there?
And oh yeah. Yeah.
So it's like, I'm rooting for Captain America because he's Captain America.
Well, yeah.
He always does. He, yeah. Much like Superman in Batman versus Superman,
mm-hmm.
You know, it was like, they were like, oh, is Superman too powerful? Is he dangerous? Is he a danger to us? Mm. And you're like, no, it's Superman. He's a good guy. He yeah. always does the right thing. How could you possibly make him into the bad guy?
Oh yeah.
But you also get Bruce Wayne's point of view in that one, mm-hmm. because he's like, he fucking destroyed Metropolis. That's like, you know, like, mm-hmm. why didn't he punch Zod out over the ocean or into space and have the fight up there? Why did he blow up half of his own city that he's supposed to be protecting?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know,
well, and I think a lot of people also made a similar mistake that I made in terms of rooting for Captain America in Civil War. I think a lot of people may have rooted for Batman and Batman v Superman, not necessarily realizing that in Batman v Superman, I mean, Lex Luthor aside.
Right.
Batman was the villain in that movie. Batman was wrong through most of that movie to be skeptical of Superman. He was just taking this, and it was, I think, triggered psychologically something in him, the Black Zero event with Zod and everything, and trying to terraform Earth into another version of Krypton and all that, the attack on Metropolis, and his reaction to that turned him into something that he wasn't prior to that event. It was like 9/11 transforming Dennis Miller from a funny person into an insufferable rat bastard. It was that kind of thing, right?
It's almost like what Tucker Carlson talks about, replacement theory. They're coming here to take away your jobs and take away your things and reformat America into something that you don't want.
That's right. Right.
But by the way, that's what's good about that. That's my favorite aspect of, and I think sci-fi gets away with it sci-fi and fantasy and comic books and all of that stuff can get away with it in a way that dramas can't necessarily, is it, it kind of turns things on its side,
mm-hmm.
and it allows you to look at something as a metaphor and you are able to imprint on it what you want.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember one day driving home this years ago, driving home from when we were, from doing the show, Stephanie's show, over when we were still at the radio studio, when mm-hmm. you first started doing the show with us.
Oh, right.
And it was when the Hunger Games books were really, really big.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something like, I don't tell many people this. I listened to Rush Limbaugh on my way home from Stephanie's. And this is back when I was screening calls, because listening to Rush Limbaugh was a good tool for me to suss out what kind of talking points callers were calling in with to try to get on the air with Stephanie. So it was kind of like, I became much happier when I stopped listening to Rush Limbaugh on the way home, because it just made me angry. But I remember one day a woman called in talking about the Hunger Games books. And I'm saying this assuming that you know the Hunger Games and people have read these books.
Oh yeah, sure, sure.
But the woman in Hunger Games, or she called in the Rush and talking about the Hunger Games. And she's like, oh, well, you know, the interesting thing about the Hunger Games is, you know, all of the rich elites, they live in the capital and they have everything they want. And they're making all the poor people and the working class people do their bidding. And then Rush Limbaugh's like, oh yeah, just like the Obamas. And I'm like sitting there going, motherfucker, that's mm-hmm. the Republican Party. And so, it really showed how you can imprint onto these characters what you see and what you want to see and whatever the narrative from your, so I'm sure that there's like a whole set of fans of the Hunger Games movies who look at it and see, you know, Snow, the bad guy, who was it? Donald Sutherland.
Yeah, yeah.
They see him as like a metaphor for Barack Obama. Which is
that's a stretch. Yeah, they were really reaching for that.
But that's what they were arguing on, yeah, on Rush Limbaugh. And I was like, going, what the fuck upside down world is this that we're living in?
Oh, yeah. Alex Jones used to compare Obama to Heath Ledger's Joker from The Dark Knight. Yeah. Completely incongruous with what Barack Obama is and was.
Because I could sit here and argue with you. If anyone was the Joker, it was Donald Trump. He was a chaos agent who just kept throwing sand in the air and pitting people against each other and trying to bring out the worst in people's instincts.
Mm-hmm.
In order to get to where he wanted to go.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's you know, or he's also the Penguin, the fat guy who runs the city. The fat crook guy who runs the city.
Yeah. Well, that's just it. I mean, I've thought all along that Donald Trump is our first real supervillain. I mean, at the very least, you can take super off of it because that's like a comic book thing. But just in terms of being a villain, he is the first villain president. We've had some shitty presidents who have done some shitty things. But yeah, Donald Trump is the first guy who has legitimately villainous intent with what he's doing. He has no interest whatsoever in doing the right thing for the country or the world. It's all about, I want more power for myself. I mean, he might as well develop like a blue laser that shoots into space and takes over the world for himself, just like any comic book supervillain would. And
someone like Lex Luthor.
Exactly right.
He's dumb Lex Luthor.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because like if you go back and look, there was at a point in the DC comic books, Lex Luthor was president.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yep.
And it was a rich businessman who's president who runs on a platform of aliens coming into our country from outer space. But, you know, but like if you look at it and, you know, we had I booked him on Happy Hour podcast years ago, John Cryer.
Because
he plays Lex Luthor on Supergirl.
Yes.
And his character was all about like, look, I'm just trying to protect you from these aliens that are coming here. And they did a whole, there was a season of Supergirl where Linda Carter was the president and it's revealed that she's an alien and John Cryer is railing against her as Lex Luthor.
Wow.
but it's like, oh yeah. Cause Linda Carter was the alien, the other, like Obama, you have, you know, Lex Luthor coming out and saying, I'm going to protect you from this invasion. These people who want to come in and, you know, replacement theory, you know, because they're better than us. They're stronger than us. We need to fight them off. We're scared of them because they're here to do the work that no one else will do. Like migrant farm workers or immigrants who come across the border. And I grew up in Fresno where like, I went to school with kids whose parents were migrant farm workers. I would be willing to bet you there are people I went to school with who would be considered dreamers today.
Okay. We'll get back to our conversation with Travis Bone here in just a second. But if you ever catch yourself thinking when looking in the mirror, I wish my under eye bags would just vanish. You're totally not alone. Bags and puffiness under the eyes are a problem for millions of American men and women until now. Introducing the new GenuCell Serum with plant stem cell technology from Chamonix. Susan from New Jersey wrote, quote, I've been using GenuCell for a couple of months. The puffiness around my eyes is gone. Even the crow's feet and small lines have disappeared and haven't come back. I love the product. I use it under my eyes, around my cheekbones, and on my eyelids, unquote. With its instant effects, Chamonix says you'll see results in the first 12 hours or your money back. They guarantee it. Order now and get 50% off all GenuCell packages for the summer. Go to lovegenucell.com/Stephanie. That's lovegenucell.com/Stephanie. Link in the description at bobseska.com. lovegenucell.com/Stephanie. Thank you.
The Bob Seska Show.
Going back to what you were saying about listening to Rush Limbaugh after the show, I want to get some background in terms of your connection to broadcasting. I mean, you're growing up in Fresno. Was radio ever in the cards for you? Was that something that you were like, you know what? This radio thing, this broadcasting thing, maybe this is something I'd like to do.
You know, I was always interested in it. The track record I took going there was like my degrees in literature and writing. I always loved writing. And I always felt like the only stable writing job there is like writing for like a newspaper or in some sort, which is also kind of laughable now.
Yeah.
But it was like, I don't like gig work. I don't like moving from job to job to job to job or freelancing.
Yeah.
And so newspaper writing was something that was like, the news writing business was something that fascinated me. When I went to school at UC San Diego, I wrote for the school paper down there. And then after I graduated, I worked for like, it was like the internet.com boom. And that's kind of like the world that I was working in for the first few years. And when that kind of all went kablooey, I went back and interned with the ABC News affiliate in San Diego the summer of 2001, which that means I was there for 9/11, which was, you know, and it was funny that I was interning there. So I was only on every other day. And that happened on a day that was my vacation day, or not my vacation day, but my day off. And I worked on the morning show. So usually I was up at 4 a.m. So my phone rings at like 7. It was a little bit before 7. And I answered it. And it was back when you actually had like a landline in your house. And I answered the phone and it was my dad. And he said, "Have you seen the news yet today?" And I was like, "No." He's like, "I knew it was your day off, so I wasn't sure if you were up early or not." I was like, "No." And he says, he's like, "We've been attacked." And I was like, "What do you mean we've been attacked?" So I, like, I'm walking into the living room and he said, planes have hit the World Trade Center. And I said, "Which tower?" And he says, "Both of them." And I'm like, "What the fuck?" And he said, "It fell down." And I was like, "Which tower?" And he's like, "They both have fallen down." And I, at that point, I'm turning on the news and I see the footage. And I was like, "Let me call the station, see what's going on."
Wow.
And that was the day they said, "Yes, come in." Raced over to the studio. They sent me out with the news crew. And it was kind of like one of those days that you'll never forget. They sent me out with the news crew to downtown where the mayor was holding his press conference to talk about the situation. And at that point, everyone thought that they were a target and they had grounded all the planes. So he was saying, you know, "This is what's being done here in San Diego. This is what's being done here in San Diego." I remember all of our crew was like, "Yeah, but there's the international airport in Tijuana that's literally like right across the border. And there are still planes flying out of there. How do we know that we're not going to have someone take off and make a right-hand turn into San Diego?"
Yeah, exactly.
So we were at that press conference. Then we went and they rang the church bells. And then one of ABC's camera crews got stuck across the border in Mexico because they shut the border down. And this is the craziest part of the story. And this is back in the day, they transmission. And I think you'll probably understand this from just work experience. Back then, transmission was line of sight to the towers.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
If they wanted to send footage. And when there's about a half a mile from the border is where you have to be. That the way the towers are set up in San Diego, mm-hmm. when you're at the border, you can't transmit.
Yeah.
About a half mile from the border, you can. Well, this ABC News camera crew had gone across the border, ABC network, not local, had gone across the border in Mexico and they couldn't get back. So we got in a van, drove down to the border where it's closed, ran up to the fence, and they handed us Betamax tapes through the fence.
Wow.
To take back to the studio to transmit to the national.
Just incredible. So you're working at the San Diego affiliate ABC News
and then I got a job writing for the Gay and Lesbian Times down there, which is like our local gay newspaper. Mm-hmm. And but again, it was a consistent paycheck, weekly gig. And I just, I wanted to write and I wanted to move to LA and I moved up to LA and, I was listening to Stephanie Miller before I moved to LA and a friend of mine, this is not going to be shocking at all, who's a gay bodybuilder in San Diego says, "Hey, I have a friend who's a gay bodybuilder. Who's a producer on a radio show. Have you ever heard of the Stephanie Miller?" I'm like, "I listen to it every day." And he's like, "Well, Chris Lavoine." I'm like, going, "He's gay?" This is back before Chris was really out on the show. I was like, "Huh?" And so like, Chris and I met, via my friend Jason and, when they were looking for an associate producer, when Rebecca, the former associate producer, was leaving, mm-hmm. Chris posted something on Facebook. And I said, "Hey, I'd be interested." And he's like, "You've got a news background experience too, don't you?" And I was like, "Yeah, I worked for the ABC affiliate and I, you know, the newspaper for years." And at that point I was working in like the finance department at 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment. So like movies, not the news side of the business or anything like that.
Wow.
And that's how I ended up working in radio.
The amazing thing about you joining that show is I think it completed this chemistry that the three main players on the Stephanie Miller show, the chemistry is, I think, unrivaled in broadcasting between Stephanie,
thank you,
Chris, and you. And so when you departed from the show, I got the sense that it was going to be next to impossible to recapture that chemistry with another group, because then I think Chris left soon after you, or is that, am I reversing this? Chris left first and then you left, or
I left first. And part of the reason I left was because we were like a standalone show, mm-hmm. we weren't a part of a bigger network. There wasn't any growth potential for me.
Yeah.
And I was like, I need to, you know, advance beyond what I'm doing right now. And, I had an opportunity to go over to SiriusXM and produce a show over there. Mm-hmm. And it was a step up from an associate producer to a producer. And that was the reason I left. It was just because I needed that opportunity for growth. And then of course, right after I leave, Chris leaves. And then I would have had it. I could have just stayed with Stephanie the whole time. Yeah. But I do think stepping away from the show and working with other talent, and then, after Sirius, I went and worked with Kevin Smith on the Geeking Out show, and, you know, got mm-hmm. more TV experience.
What was that like? Did you enjoy working with Kevin?
Loved it.
Yeah,
absolutely loved it. He is the nicest guy in the world. It was him and Greg Grunberg, who is also mm-hmm. just amazing. Greg's done. He did the Happy Hour podcast, and he did in studio with us a few times even. Mm-hmm. And Greg is, if you don't follow him, he is awesome. He is just the most wonderful man in the world. And he's, it's weird because he grew up with JJ Abrams.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. They were best friends growing up, and everything that JJ Abrams ever did, Greg Berlanti was either in or had cameos or reoccurring roles. Mm-hmm. And so he's in that. So it was working with Greg and Kevin, and it was great. I both of those guys, I think the world of,
yeah,
and it was so much fun.
I only met Kevin once, but I was kind of shocked in a good way in terms of how similar his private persona is to his public persona. What you see with Kevin Smith is what you get with Kevin Smith.
He is the real deal.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's funny. Even since working on the show, randomly I'll like run into him at like, well, RIP, the Arclight Theaters here in LA, mm-hmm. which was like the beautiful theater here that everyone went to. It was the best movie experience you could have. They shut down during the pandemic and they went bankrupt. Mm-hmm. But, I would just randomly run into him at the Arclight. He'd be like, oh, hey, you know, or there's a Mexican restaurant. There's a Mexican restaurant a block from us. And I'm not going to say he's a stoner, but he would stop there when he had the munchies.
Yeah. Oh, he's completely out when his wake and bake activities. Yeah.
Yes. Oh yeah. My gosh. Going by his trailer.
I can't even imagine. Sure.
Yeah. In fact, I remember that when we filmed the pilot for Geeking Out, this would make you jealous. I'd been to Comic-Con mm-hmm. many times.
Yeah.
Many, many times.
You do cosplaying too, right? Yeah.
At Comic-Con, I've never dressed up at Comic-Con, oddly enough.
Wow.
Like Halloween. Uh-huh. Halloween's when I dress up.
Okay.
But we go to, I finally like made the break. It's like Comic-Con just got too big. It's too out of control. Mm-hmm. I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not going to Comic-Con. And a friend of mine calls me up and he's like, hey, we're putting a show together. We're looking for producers. He's like, we don't have anyone that has your experience with the nerd culture and Comic-Con and stuff like that. We're literally filming the pilot at Comic-Con. Would you be interested in this? And I was like,
no.
Wait. With Kevin Smith going into Comic-Con to film a pilot. Fuck yes, thank you.
Please. Absolutely, yeah.
So I got on board for that, and it was like literally the year I'd sworn off going to Comic-Con. I told them, oh, I'm going back to Comic-Con. And so we go to Comic-Con, and it was the first time I'd ever been at Comic-Con where I was behind the scenes. And there was no season two of the show, so we never went back for another season more Comic-Con. But it was the most fun I'd ever had. We got to go to parties I would have never have gone to. We got to go to, got access to people that we would never had access to. Kevin was doing stuff for, aside from our show, he was on the IMDb yacht that was parked in the harbor there in San Diego. And if you're not familiar with the Comic-Con, this convention center is right on the waterfront. And there's, you know, I mean, crazy yachts parked right behind the center.
Please tell me that IMDb rented the yacht, that they don't actually own a yacht. Okay, good.
Yes. But it was called the IMDb yacht. And so like we're on the IMDb yacht and like Bruce Campbell, mm-hmm. Lee Majors, like all these people are just coming through to like do interviews. And then where we had our base camp was at a hotel nearby where like all the, it was kind of like it was like Radio Row or at any of these events you go to, where it's just like you could go from like one suite to the next to talk to talent, or the talent would come to you actually. So we were all kind of camped out over there. And the last day we were filming, we'd gone over to the convention center, we'd gotten B-roll and crazy people in their cosplay outfits and stuff like that. And I had this crew with me, and we go back and we get in the elevator, and like, we've got sound equipment, camera equipment. It's the last day, we're wrapping up, so everything's packed. And we're getting in the elevator to go up to our floor where our like interview area was, and it stops, and the elevator doors open up, and Tom Hiddleston is standing there.
Oh, holy shit. Loki himself.
And it's
yeah.
And it's a full elevator. And I'm just, and we're, and he's like looking at us, and we're looking at him, and we're like, sorry, it's full. All full. And he's like, I'll take the next one. And as soon as like the elevator doors close, like everyone in our elevator is just like, that was Loki.
That's amazing. I guess it's just because what, the show just didn't get picked up for a second season. Is that how you ended up thinking, you know what, maybe I should talk to Stephanie again, see if there's a spot for me over there, go back to the morning show.
I worked on a couple of other pilots and video game shows and stuff like that.
Oh, okay.
But it was freelance, which I did not like.
Yeah.
I did not like that going on and off work. They reached out to me actually about coming in for the executive producer position.
Oh, that's nice. And, yeah.
And so I remember when they first asked me, I was like, well, I'm going to need to talk to Dylan, 'cause we're getting married this year, and I don't know how he's going to feel about me working these crazy weird hours again.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You know, we've obviously made it work, and it's not been a problem, but.
Do you guys function on different schedules, or does he adapt to your schedule? Do you guys work it out that way, or how do you deal with waking up at scary o'clock or whatever it is?
So we've made it work, and we made it work this last year during pandemic. We were both working from home, which was, that was amazing.
Oh, yeah.
But and it's kind of funny because we live in a one bedroom apartment in West Hollywood, which it's rent control, so we're never leaving. we can't. If you know anything about LA and I say rent control, you'll understand why.
Oh, sure.
We're never leaving. He's been here for over 10 years now. But anyways, so what, the way our schedule works is I usually go to bed around 9 o'clock. He goes to bed, you know, 10 or so. He's not a night owl either. He's a morning person, not stupid morning person like me. But I do most of my work the night before. Like I usually pull audio clips. You know, every once in a while you'll wake up to like Cory Booker giving a speech like he did this morning.
Yeah.
That barn burner of a speech. But most of the time I'll do all of my stuff in the evenings, early evenings, and have everything lined up. And then I get up at 4 a.m. So it's not, Chris gets up at like 1 or 2 in the morning.
Yeah. Chris, and when he was doing your job, he was getting up. Yeah. I remember him saying,
he still gets up at that time.
Oh, that's insane.
I don't understand. I don't understand that.
Yeah.
But just for us in our lifestyle, it's like, you know, being able to stay up to 9, you know, we'll eat dinner around 6 o'clock, you know, and just chill and watch TV, and then I'll go to bed and he can read a book or watch a movie that has a lot more culture and class than I would ever watch.
Yeah.
And he's been working his way through the Kurosawa films lately.
Oh my God. Well, the thing with prepping for a Stephanie Miller show is not only you're printing out all of the news items for the various stacks, right? But you're also, as you said, you're gathering that audio. That's got to be the most time consuming aspect of it, because you're not only watching all of this bullshit that comes down from Fox News and wherever else, the worst of the worst speeches and press availabilities and so on, and then going through and picking out which clips to save. Not only is that a process in and of itself, deciding which clips to use, but then also the nuts and bolts of recording the audio, saving the audio, organizing the audio. Yeah. That's, I don't think people truly appreciate how much time that alone requires.
You know, some days it's easier than other days.
Yeah.
And it's nice. Like, what was it? I shouldn't say the word nice. Like the day they had the officers testified. For the January 6th commission, it was like, well, I know where all my audio is coming from. It's like, and that was done in the morning, and it's, Twitter has made things a lot easier. I don't know how you source stuff, but Twitter has made things a lot easier for me to go and grab.
Yeah, yeah. Aaron Rupar for me. As long as I have, yeah, because I've got a, right now on my browser window, I've got about 1,000 tabs, and they're mostly Aaron Rupar tweets.
Yeah, no, you know what I do is I email myself the tweets, so I just have them all there in my mail folder, and then I have to go through and clean that out. But Aaron Rupar, there's another one I'd recommend. His name is Acyn.
Acyn, yeah, he's another good
A-C-Y-N.
One.
Acyn. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's really good. There was a guy named Bobby Lewis who was really, really good on Fox and Friends, all of the morning stuff, and he works for Media Matters now.
Oh, okay.
So he's really, really solid. And then and there's other people I pick up on. Do you follow The Recount?
Yeah, well, and Daniel Dale, I think, from CNN, used to post a lot of clips during Trump. Yes. And now he's working at CNN as a fact checker or something like that, so he's not doing as much video. But, yeah, he was another source that I would find audio clips from. It was very, very useful. Yeah.
The Recount, if you don't follow them.
Oh, right.
They post a lot of really good audio, too. So Twitter has made, and there's plugins and extensions you can get for your browser. I'm sure you have them, too.
Oh, yeah.
Where you can just download the video clip right to your computer and then convert to MP3 and cut and edit and stuff like that.
I do a whole different thing, yeah. But, yeah.
But sometimes, and I'm sure you've had this happen before. It's where, like, you'll hear an interview or you'll see a clip or you're, like, in your car, you're listening somewhere, and you're like, oh, I need that audio.
Oh,
I've got to find. Yeah. And there are certain days where it's, like, a needle in a haystack.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to find.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Sometimes it's like you Google it and or you go do a YouTube search or even a Twitter search.
Yeah.
And it's always coming up with the wrong one. It's always coming up with the video clip that someone shot off of their TV using their camera phone. And the audio is terrible. And you don't want that one. But that's always the one that comes up, right?
Yeah. I remember there was one. I think it was Sean Patrick Maloney, Representative Sean Patrick Maloney, when he was talking to Sondland during one of the impeachment hearings. And it was like, it was something where he just like leaned into him. And he's like, you think you're a hero. You are not a hero. You were there. The only reason you're here right now is because we asked you to come in. Mm-hmm. I mean, he laid into him and it was like one of those barn burner moments. And I was like, I've got to find this.
Yeah.
And it had, it was like, I was searching every way I could. And I never realized that Sean Patrick Maloney was gay until I was searching for that clip. And I kept doing all these different searches on him. And I kept getting results about him and his husband and their three kids. And I was like, oh, well, not only is he a great congressman, he's also a homo.
Just incredible. So
it's like, he's a team player.
Is there like a Stephanie Miller Show Rolodex for all of these potential guests, or are you basically doing what the rest of us are doing, which is, you know, Twitter DMs? Like if a blue check starts following me on Twitter, I start the countdown clock before I have to send them a DM to say, hey, you want to be on my podcast? But there's got to be like thousands of us all doing that at the same time. Hey, do you want to be on my podcast? So is that kind of the process, or do you have a more legitimate system that maybe they use, like professional bookers at like the late night shows or something use, or is it a
mix? We don't have bookers. So it's a lot of legwork.
Yeah.
It's a lot of legwork and it's a lot of, educating them about the show. And then, just because you get someone to say yes, getting them booked is a whole different, ball game. there's some people that I chased after for months and months and months and months and months. And I'm still like, I'm going back and forth trying to get Michael Cohen for the show.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you say, yeah. And then when I actually ask him to do it, then it's like crickets. So it's like, don't tell me yes. And then not answer when I actually propose a time. But, it's kind of like that. It's the networking thing. Mm-hmm. Stephanie sometimes will go to Politicon or these events when those things occurred, and she'll meet a bunch of people.
Okay.
And then she'll come back and like, send me here's a contact. And it's like a name and a phone number or a name and email address and stuff like that. But, I also use, not so much now, but when we were booking more of the celebrity guests for happy hour and that was a lot of work too, was, IMDb Pro. If you have an account with IMDb Pro, it has, agents and managers and contact information. Oh, like that.
You know what? I completely forgot about that. That's a great idea. I'm going to steal that from you. Yeah.
So when you're looking for celebrities to do stuff, and I don't have an account, but my husband, who works in the entertainment industry, does. So
yeah.
That's the reason. That's the way I've always approached it. But it's I call it the buckshot method. It's like whatever, just fire as many shots as you can in many different directions, and hopefully, like, somebody will respond to you.
You know how I feel about Stephanie. I think she is the gold standard. I so incredibly admire Stephanie Miller and what she's been able to achieve, her style on the show, her tenacity, her consistency. I imagine that there is a lot of prep work that you have to do in terms of adapting first-time guests to Stephanie's style with interviewing. Because she's very in your face. She's very forward about what she says to guests. And that's part of the charm of the show, of course. But I imagine, was there any occasion where you booked a guest, the guest was on the show, and then afterward you hear back going, what the fuck was that? Why was she asking me about my penis or whatever, wherever Stephanie ends up going?
She doesn't cross that line as much now that she's not drinking. So... That was more of a happy hour thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, in fact, you were joking around about the time that she made out with Beverly D'Angelo after one of the happy hour podcasts this morning.
Oh, man. Yeah. Those were the days.
It's funny. Most people, once I get them booked and get them on the show, they are, you would not believe the number of times I've actually had people reach out to me afterwards and go, that was so much fun.
Yeah.
I had such a good, like Matthew Miller, who's on MSNBC, the former DOJ spokesperson, who seems so like clean cut and dry and proper. And
he's always put together. That's for sure. Yeah.
The first time he did the show, he was like, I don't usually get to let my hair down like that. He's like, that was so much fun.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You know, we had, didn't communicate this directly to me, but we had Eric Holder on, 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And he, the people that we booked him through, they emailed back and he said he had a great time.
That
he
was
had
a
such a good time.
Yeah. That was a great, and he
and
seemed
it was a
solid
interview.
Yeah. And he loved it. He seemed to really get into the whole call me your highness and all of the honorifics. And yeah, that was a lot of fun.
And it's, you know, and some people show up and they're like, they show up to play ball, you know, and that makes it so much fun because we've had like, you know, we have a lot of different people from Congress and stuff like that come on, but like, you know, we have our favorites, you know, like John Yarmuth is always chuckly and talking about his bourbon. I remember the first time we had Adam Schiff on, it was when they redistricted the area here. Cause Henry Waxman was the congressman
for
this area and they redistricted, and Adam Schiff's people contacted us and wanted him to come in. And that this is where the whole smooth jazz congressman thing started. And it just watching his evolution over the years from, I don't want to say timid, but reserved.
Yeah.
And you've seen him loosen up over the years, and you see it when he's doing like his network interviews now and stuff. And I'm not saying that we're the reason he's like that, but you can tell that he's loosened up over the years as far as doing his interviews. And he went from being our smooth jazz congressman to like, he's doing a stand-up night here in LA. Like it's a fundraiser event at like Flappers Comedy Club or something like that, you know, coming up.
That's incredible.
Soon.
Yeah.
And it's, but like just to watch that evolution of someone like that. And it's like, and I think she does kind of like put people at ease and bring them out of their shells. Like Richard Marx.
Oh,
I had no idea what
it was.
I realized, we're going back 2 years now, that he was following me on Twitter. And I'm like, what the fuck? Richard Marx is following me?
I know the feeling. Yeah.
And so like, and he's so good on Twitter, and he's so funny, and he you know, he's not afraid to go after people. And that's how I look for guests, is like, you know, if you're smart and you aren't afraid to talk politics in your Twitter feed, I'm pretty sure you're a good guest for our show.
Interesting. Yeah.
And that's how we got, I realized that he was following the show, and I DM'd him, like you said. And you know, a couple weeks later, he's in studio with us.
Okay, one last break here. Who doesn't love hanging out in loungewear? Loungewear used to be code for hideously ugly sweatpants. Even your pets have been judging you when you wear those things. Well, that's a thing of the past with Cozy Earth. The people known for creating luxuriously soft, cool sheets made of bamboo have done it again. They've taken loungewear to another level with their comfy, super soft selections in gorgeous styles and colors. From wonderful pajama sets, leggings, and tees, every item is sourced from earth-friendly viscose from bamboo for enhanced breathability and temperature regulation. You'll find something you can't lounge without at Cozy Earth. See why Oprah described Cozy Earth's pajamas as the softest ever in O Magazine. And best of all, go to CozyEarth.com now. Enter the promo code Stephanie35. That's Stephanie35 and save 35% on their loungewear and bedding. That's CozyEarth.com, promo code Stephanie35, CozyEarth.com. Thank you.
The Bob Seska Show.
Well, I have to say, I am so immensely grateful that you sent me that email back in 2013 and said, hey, do you want to be on the Stephanie Miller Show?
Because Stephanie is the one who found you. So yeah, that was, and I don't remember how I tracked you down.
I just think it was through Twitter or the Daily Banter or something like that, because I know at that period of time I was writing a lot about the Snowden NSA Glenn Greenwald thing. And so I was spending a lot of time on that. And then you contacted me and I was on the show, and that
was
one
also
of the,
early in the morning for you.
It was very, because I was living in Hawaii at the time. So I had to get up super early. I think I was getting up like at a Chris level of earliness. Like, I think I was getting up at like 3 o'clock in the morning, because Hawaii's 3 hours behind LA. And so I was not only exhausted, but then I would have to suck down caffeine. And then on top of that, I was, you know, the adrenaline was pumping because I wanted to make a good impression, because I had been listening to the Stephanie Miller Show for years, going back to, you know, Sirius XM in 2006, 2007, and that period of time. And so I was familiar with the show and I admired the show. And in fact, there was one period of time in which Buzz Burbank, who's my Tuesday co-host, he was going for his own show on WJFK, which is where I had interned in radio with the Don and Mike show and so on. And Buzz was still there. And so he and I were in conversations about his potential show on WJFK. And I was saying to him, yeah, you got to listen to this Stephanie Miller show, because that's the way you do political comedy on the radio. That's, again, I keep using this phrase, but it was the gold standard. And so once I get the opportunity to actually be on the show, I have to confess, I was nervous as fuck for like the first two, three months. It was just like, and then when I was in studio for the first time, I don't know if it showed, it probably did, because I was nervous as hell that first time I was actually in studio, which must have been 2015 or something like that. It was a couple of years later,
That was when we were at our house too.
Yeah. I was never in the studio, actual the radio studio. Yeah. Yeah. But the point I'm getting at here is that email that you sent me to invite me to be on the show changed the trajectory of my entire life in all the best ways possible, because not only do I get to be on one of my all-time favorite radio shows, and a show that I appreciate from a nuts and bolts broadcasting point of view as much as it is from the political comedy point of view, but also to gain access to that listenership, because Stephanie Miller Show listeners are among the most fanatical and loyal radio listeners I have ever known. And I came up in radio with the Don and Mike show in Washington, D.C. And you talk about some loyal listeners. They had some really loyal listeners, Washingtonians, people in the D.C. Metroplex loving that show. But it pales in comparison to the listeners of the Stephanie Miller show in terms of not only their participation, but their support for the show and their support for the people who are in that, what I call the Stephanie Miller extended cinematic universe.
The family.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The family. No, it's like a series of orbits that Stephanie has created, where she's like the star at the center, and there's different orbits of different planets and then moons circulating the planets and so on. And I look at it that way. And her listeners are so wired to the views and likes and dislikes of you three on the show, that when you guys say, like, for example, Chris Lavoie saying, hey, I was listening to this Bob and Chez show, this podcast, then everyone suddenly goes, vroom. And then there are now thousands and thousands of Stephanie Miller Show listeners listening to whatever it is I'm doing. And so in that respect, this was a tremendous opportunity. And I hope some of the other guests who appear on the show truly appreciate the value to their own projects that being on the Stephanie Miller Show provides. It's incredible.
Last week we had Mia Bloom on the show, who I just connected with Kimberly for her podcast.
Oh yeah.
Who has this book out called Pastels and Pedophiles, and it's about women getting involved in QAnon. And she emailed us that night. She's like, we're back in the top 10 book sales.
There you go. Exactly.
And I was like, oh no, that's the Stephanie Miller effect. She has the most loyal audience you could ever ask for. And they support what Stephanie supports, and they support the people who support Stephanie, like you. You know, I to this day, and it's every once in a while, because of the pandemic, not so much, but like Dylan and I went and saw like a play here at the Pantages a couple of years ago, and we went and got ice cream afterwards, and we're staying there, and somebody goes, "Is that Travis Bone?" There's only one reason. There's only one reason people recognize me anywhere. And it's from the Stephanie Miller Show.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's like one of those things where like, and Dylan always like laughs, you know, that's my husband.
Well, you know, when I was first on the show, when you first invited me on the show, I was doing my podcast as sort of a side gig because I was mainly writing at the time. I was writing for the Daily Banter, a couple other places. And the podcast was merely a thing that I loved doing, but it wasn't the main thing that I was doing. Now, doing my podcast is my full-time job. I do it 4 days a week, plus extra shows here and there, Indie Music Countdown and so on. And it's all because of the platform that you and Chris and Stephanie especially provided for me. And that has allowed me to do this thing that I've always, I'm getting really soupy about this, but it's the thing that I've always, always wanted to do. When I was in eighth grade, I was recording fake radio shows in my bedroom. When I was in eighth grade. Now I'm recording fake radio shows in my bedroom for a living as my actual job. And podcasting is real, but it's also kind of a fake version of broadcasting. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah, no, I remember like editing together, like, you know, like the dual cassette tapes where you'd have music and you talk and you do it, like trying to do everything together or like have music playing in the background, but never quite sounded as good coming through the microphone. You know, all those like the things you did as a kid or playing with the camcorder and stuff like that. But it's crazy now to have the equipment. And it's also gotten to the point where it's like so exciting. Like these freaking the virtual tour, the Sexy Liberal virtual tour, we're shooting those on iPhones. It's just crazy, like how much you can do and how much, you know, and I'm always learning something new as far as like video or audio editing or, you know, sound mixing and stuff like that. And it's like, and you get to play with different aspects of, I've always been a creative person, like whether it was as kids, I was drawing or playing with my Legos or, you know, and I think that's, you know, we were talking at the beginning, like Transformers are like an entryway for me into like a lot of stuff. And to me, Transformers were so creative because like there was this tactile thing of changing from one to another, and it was interactive. And I think that's probably the reason those toys stuck with me. And some days when I'm stressed out, I'll literally go, I have a shelf in my bedroom of kind of like you've got there, your display cases. Yours are much nicer, much more organized. But I will literally go get a Transformer off the shelf. And just if I need to do something tactile or take my mind off something, I'll just sit there and transform it back and forth.
Yeah.
It's like a stress ball for me.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's not, and it's like, some days I'm in the mood for something that's really easy to transform it. Some days I'm in the mood for something that's complex to transform. You know, it's just, it's my goofy thing that I do, you know, or like I said, I watch cartoons, you know, in the afternoon to like de-stress.
Yeah. Yeah.
And stuff, but I don't know. I kind of went off on a tangent there, but what I love about working on the show is I get to be creative and playful.
Yeah.
And think outside the box on a daily basis.
Oh, yeah. It's the best job in the world. And not only because you get to be silly for 3 hours, or in the case of doing a broadcast show, but also I think one of the coolest things about broadcasting or podcasting is you're still on a lower rung of the entertainment industry. You're still on like,
oh yeah,
I feel like a few more rungs down is just porn. That's where you go. Broadcasting, podcasting, maybe a couple of things in there, and then porn.
Magazine writing, print magazine writing is probably down there.
Right. Yeah, somewhere down there. But in that, in that respect, it's also, there's a comfort in that. There's a low, lower, I mean, there's obviously pressure and stress and awfulness that you have to deal with. It's just part of, part of doing a job. But there's much less than you would experience maybe doing a TV series or something else in the entertainment industry that's much more high pressure, where there's more people involved. There's more creative input coming from people wearing suits and ties. You know what I mean?
Oh,
but what we're doing,
the show with Kevin Smith.
Yeah.
That, I mean, getting network notes and approving ideas for stories. And, you know, the way we put that show together, it was like the team that it took for us to put together 1 half-hour show, like what the work that went into 1 half-hour episode of that show compared to the work I do for a 3-hour episode of the Stephanie Miller Show.
Yeah.
It's like we planned for weeks and weeks and weeks just for one episode.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
You know, on those things and scheduling shoots and, you know, going out and crews and all this. I mean, it was absolutely bananas.
Yeah.
What it was like, the planning and production work.
Oh yeah. And what we do, there's planning and production, but a little bit, and then most of it is improvised. That's just the crazy thing. There is no script. It's all spontaneous. Whatever comes out, that's the thing. And there's something that's exciting about that too. Live. So little of entertainment is live anymore. And to be able to do live radio is a real, there's something that's absolutely addictive about it. It's addictive to talk into a microphone for a living. It's even more addictive to do it in front of a live audience.
Oh yeah. No, we, for those segments on Geeking Out, like, you know, it was a 30-minute show. You figure in commercial breaks, it's about 20 minutes. You know, you'd have like a 5-minute segment or a 5-minute interview or something like that with somebody. And you would literally, you would probably film for an hour and then it would all get cut down to just like a 5-minute chunk.
Yeah.
And you're always waiting to see like which parts made it in. Did this one, did the question I pitched get in there? You know, there was so much that was, and we even said that there was so much that was left on the table for that show. It was frustrating. We did a stunt at Comic-Con, and I cannot believe the footage of this never got used anywhere on the show. There was, what we decided to do was like, people at Comic-Con, have you ever been to Comic-Con?
I've never been. No, no.
Okay. It got to the point where people would camp out overnight to wait for these shows. And, the Hall H is like the one where like the big things were. Right? And there were people who were camped out the day we got the Comic-Con starts. Like there's like a preview night early on Wednesday. We got there Wednesday morning, and there were already people camped out because they wanted to see the Game of Thrones cast, and they were wearing Game of Thrones costumes. Mm-hmm. And that's not until Saturday. And they were camped out on Wednesday.
Jesus. Yeah.
Ready to go. And the stunt that we put together was, we'd found a gourmet donut shop in San Diego, and we were going to, Kevin Smith and Greg Grunberg delivered donuts to people waiting, who had been waiting in line for 4 days for the Game of Thrones panel.
Unbelievable.
And we got there in the morning before they let anyone into the, we handed out like 10 dozen donuts in a matter of like 5 minutes. It was like a free for all. Cause like you got Kevin Smith and Greg Grunberg walking into this crowd of people who've been camped out for 4 days, and they've got coffee and donuts. They lost their minds.
Yeah.
I never saw the footage.
In fact, I would say Kevin Smith's fandom is almost as loyal and energized as Stephanie's fandom.
Yeah. Very much so. Yeah. People went nuts, and it was so much fun. Everyone was like, that was the best thing. That was the best thing we filmed, the comment. And it never made it into the episode because we had so much other, like, you know, interviews with celebrities. And like, we had Heath Ledger and we had Matt Damon in the show, and Matt Damon and Charlie Hunnam from Sons of Anarchy.
Oh, okay. Right.
He was in it because he had just done a King Arthur movie. Mm-hmm. So we had like big name interviews and stuff like that, that we had to like get in there.
Yeah.
And it just, this stunt that we pulled off got left on the floor. And I don't know if, I'm sure the footage is somewhere, but that footage never got, they didn't even release it as a bonus thing on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, how could you leave something like that on the floor? You've got Comic-Con fans going nuts because Kevin and Greg, and we had like donuts that had like the logo for the show on them.
Oh my God. Wow.
Like it was crazy. It was absolutely crazy. Mm. And people, it was like one of those things I look back now. I'm just like, I don't know what happened to that footage, but we also, that took like so much planning and coordination to do.
Yeah.
Up in smoke.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's what happens. It's like that. That's what killed me. Just coming full circle real quick about the theatrical version of Justice League. And after seeing Zack Snyder's Justice League and seeing all of that amazing footage that would have been just left on the cutting room floor. Like, oh my God, all of that amazing work. It's ultimately disposable. If it's not needed, just it's gone. Just crazy.
I don't know if I told you this before. A friend of, I'm going to be very secretive about the connection here. Yeah. A friend of a friend's husband worked on Justice League.
Yeah.
Both versions. And this person worked in Zack Snyder's camp. And when it was, when things started going south with the whole Justice League project, his job, this is how the Snyder Cut's not been that they literally said, apparently like the Warner Bros. Execs came and said, you've got this happening in this movie, but we can't sell toys based on this. And so that's when things started to go south. And his job was to preserve as much of the Snyder footage that had been edited and strung out into the full like 4-hour extravaganza.
So he was like, and this rear guard move that was like, let's save the army as it's retreating kind of thing.
They tried to make sure as much of that was preserved so that when a Snyder cut became an option, they could go in and put in all the final visual effects,
just unbelievable.
And stuff like that.
Yeah.
But it was like, it sounded like it was just absolutely, but it was like you're talking about all the work that goes into it that, you know, we wouldn't have seen that.
Right.
If they hadn't preserved that footage. But I know that because I know how much you love Justice League. I want to make sure you heard that story. I knew you'd get a kick out of that over the Joss Whedon version.
We're still going to hear stories about that for many, many years about what happened with that. Just such a strange phenomenon between those two films and what went on at DC and Warner Brothers. Holy shit. Well, my friend, I can't thank you enough for we've gone thank super long, but I'm really looking forward to your project that you're talking about with regard to comic books.
I know,
I'm
sorry. I feel like I'm being like a teasy little minx on that one, but I'm working on it. I've got the first two interviews set up for it.
Yeah.
And that's all I can say.
Well, if you ever need a panelist, I'm available.
Oh, no, believe me, you are on the list. It's like, no, I believe me, that's the sexy liberal army. And all of our regulars and stuff like that. That's all fair game for this project.
Is there anything else you want to plug here at the end?
No, I mean, if people want to follow me on Twitter, it's @TheRealTBone. I don't post a whole lot on Instagram, but
you post some great shit on Instagram too, right? Is that like a public thing that you do? Is that something that's not a private account? Yeah.
No, I have two Instagrams. One is Trav Prime, and that was my original one where I just, my little Lego.
That's the fun one that I was just talking about. That's one of my favorites.
And then and I haven't been posting on there a lot lately. During the pandemic, I just didn't. I don't know. It wasn't happening.
Well, you're not going out to many places to pose those Transformers and things, right? They're Transformers, aren't they?
They're Transformer Legos.
Legos, right? Okay, gotcha.
But or they're not even Legos. They're like an off-brand, like janky,
like GoBots were. Yeah,
they're like the GoBots of Legos. Right. They're like Transformers GoBots of Legos. and then my other one is because the real T-Bone was not available. It is the one and only T-Bone.
Okay. Perfect.
Is my other one. And that's where you'll see more of me and cocktails or food like that. Or when we're doing commercials for Wild Alaskan Salmon, you'll see my salmon recipes there. Okay.
Well, I've got links in the description for all of that stuff. So
thank you so much. I appreciate it.
But thank you again, my friend. We're definitely going to do this again, and lots of comic book movie stuff to cover.
When's the next one coming out that we have to talk about?
Yeah, we're going to have to do it again in a couple of months. I hope people like it. I think it's a lot of fun to talk about that shit. And every time we do, I get more requests for it. So yeah, why not?
There is a huge crossover fan base between pop culture and politics. Yep. That's like my niche in the Stephanie Miller verse and your niche too.
Okay. Well, thank you again. And I guess it's your time. It's your bedtime. I guess it's time for you to.
No, I have a half hour to print all of Stephanie's show prep.
Oh, there you go. All right. Well, take care, my friend. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you very much,
Bob. Take it easy.
Yes, bye-bye. We'll see you on Wednesday.
You bet. Bye-bye.